it might sound like an odd thing to say that I don't know is the guiding principle of leadership, but actually most of us work in such complex roles in such complex arenas where we're trying to change things through the acquisition of information and application of knowledge that we can't know everything. And I think that humility is absolutely critical to building successful teams.
Hey everyone, this is Ben Morton. It's great to be talking to you again, and thank you for joining me for episode 28 of the show. In this episode, we are joined by Brian Dow, who is the Deputy Chief Executive of Rethink Mental Illness. He's also the Managing Director of Mental Health UK, a coalition of four charities across the UK, and he represents Rethink Mental Illness on the Richmond Group of major health charities in the UK. On top of all of that, Brian is also the co-chair of the National Suicide Prevention Alliance. So a very busy man doing a lot of great work. Brian began his career as a broadcast journalist in Scotland, later moving to the BBC in London, and has spent 20 years since then in the voluntary sector with organisations including Shelter, the School Food Trust, and the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health. I am so pleased to be able to share this episode with you, as mental health is such an important topic, one I'm becoming more and more interested about myself, and I think it's potentially more important now than it ever has been. In this conversation, we really focused in on what leaders can be doing on a very practical level right now to look after the mental health and well-being of those that they lead, those around them, and of course, for themselves or ourselves. So without any further delay, let's dive right in and please enjoy my conversation with Brian Dow. Brian, a very warm welcome to this episode of the podcast. And for the listeners, because they won't know this, but actually it's our second recording, isn't it, after last week's technical hitches.
It is, and let's just hope it's as enjoyable as experience as it was last time, Ben. But yes, my apologies for the technological glitches. Hopefully this will run nice and smoothly.
I don't think it was you, Brian, so no need to apologise. And it did get me thinking, actually. I wonder if sort of West End performers ever have an amazing pre-opening rehearsal and then have the worries that the actual show's not going to quite be as good. Who knows?
Well, no show's ever the same, is it? So let's see if we can make this a Sunday best.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Brian, let's dive straight in. And the first question I always love to ask guests, which you know because I asked you this last week, is really the context question. So for the benefit of everybody listening, can you just give us sort of a brief overview or a little bit of your journey that got you to where you are and what the current role is, please?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, after I left university, I was a journalist for 3 or 4 years, and you know, I enjoyed it a lot. I found myself in all sorts of peculiar positions, interviewing prime ministers and all the rest. And I enjoyed it, but it was a conversation really that I had in a very peculiar situation, really, that sort of lodged in my head for many years afterwards. And following a couple of years at the BBC, I moved into the voluntary sector. And I suppose that question really was, why are you doing what you're doing? And I think if you can't answer that question, then you know you're probably in the wrong career line, because I think that sense of passion or that sense of purpose is so important in a role. And I think when I moved over to the voluntary sector about years ago, I just that's what I found, is that here was a way of working, trying to, you know, use your professional expertise in order to advance various different causes in people's lives, has just felt a huge privilege. So I've worked in some small charities that you probably wouldn't have heard of, or your listeners won't have heard of, and some bigger ones, including Shelter and a couple of others. And then I found myself working I have a slightly strange setup, and I'm Deputy Chief Executive of Rethink Mental Illness, and I'm also Chief Executive of Mental Health UK. Mental Health UK is really the kind of child, if you like, of, of Rethink. And it's just an enormous privilege to be able to kind of go into work every day, you know, with brilliant, well, I say go into work, but, you know, mostly sit from home at the minute, but work with brilliant colleagues and to feel that you are doing something to make an issue that, you know, affects you personally, that you and your family, and make it better for everyone else. So, yeah, it's a great honour to do the work that I'm doing, and I'm really, really passionate about it.
And Brian, what would you say, having worked in many organisations and across sectors, how do you think that career journey has shaped you as a leader? And what would you say are one or two of the most significant lessons in leadership that you've learned along the way?
Yeah, it's a really good question, because, I mean, in a way, I think you've always got to keep learning, haven't you? I mean, I think leadership, the nature of it, has changed an awful lot. I mean, when I kind of started out in management, you know, if I'm honest, looking back, I think I fell into a lot of the pitfalls, particularly that men, I think, fall into. You know, you try and solve problems, you kind of focus on the task. If I'm frank, in retrospect, possibly a bit of a my way or the highway mentality. I know best, that's why I'm in this position. And I think just through kind of various getting things wrong, I've kind of learned to adapt. And I think in a strange sort of way, I think the single most important lesson, if any of your listeners have ever read Daniel Kahneman's books, Thinking Fast and Slow, he talks about the fact that we are so affected by the biases in our life that we don't often notice what's happening in front of us. It's the kind of system one, system two thinking that, you know, your kind of fast, proactive brain is constantly supplying with information. And actually that effort to be thoughtful about things doesn't always come quite as naturally to us as it should, as it certainly should for leaders. So I've kind of learned that sometimes the most powerful answer as a leader is to say, I don't know. I don't know what the answer to that is. And to try to equip teams to come together to find solutions to particular challenges. And that for me, I think, is the kind of guiding principle. It might sound like an odd thing to say that I don't know is the guiding principle of leadership, but actually most of us work in such complex roles in such complex arenas where we're trying to change things through the acquisition of information and application of knowledge that we can't know everything. And I think that humility is absolutely critical to building successful teams.
It's fascinating, Brian, that what you shared there around being able to say, I don't know, is such a strong theme that comes across from so many of the leaders that I've had the sort of privilege to interview on this show. It just comes across loud and clear. And many people talk about this moment where they realize that actually, I don't need to have all the answers. And if I'm trying to have all of the answers, then I'm becoming the bottleneck or the blocker or the thing that's stifling ideas and growth of the organization, be that profit making or a charitable organization. But the question that comes to me with that in mind, Brian, like, how did you train yourself to be able to stop, listen, pause, say I don't know and not jump in? I think that's something that many people wrestle with, right? Because we tend to get promoted as a result of having all of the ideas and being able to answer questions. So there comes a point, I think, a certain leadership transition where we suddenly need to stop doing some of the stuff that's got us to where we are.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. It's you know, beware of the Peter principle, that you're promoted to your level of incompetence. and it's true, isn't it, that you're good at one job, so the management above you decides that, you know, or you leave and you get a better paid or a higher status job. And careers aren't really very linear anymore. And the experience that really sticks in my mind was pretty early in my career. By the way, that doesn't mean that I got things right from there on in. But it was in my first job in the voluntary sector, actually, that we were working on a huge human rights conference in Paris. And it was kind of my first time in kind of proper management. And a bit like the old journalist I was at heart, I came in one day and my colleague who was reporting to me was in tears. She was really distressed. And long and short of it was that this conference in Paris was about to go belly up. You know, it was about to fall apart. It would have been a disaster. We had, you know, the French president's wife as a keynote speaker, just to put it in perspective. And essentially what she said was, look, this is your fault. You're not supporting me. And, you know, I kind of battered that back and, no, I've told you exactly what you need to do. You know, you know the deadlines. You've got the money to do it. I didn't really buy that it was my fault. And, of course, what I realised, probably not quite as quickly as I should have done, is she was absolutely right, because I'd made that fatal mistake. I'd thought about the task, but I hadn't thought about the person doing the task. And I hadn't really been checking in to understand how she was doing and, you know, what was kind of proceeding well and what wasn't. And I think that experience was really career-changing for me, because it just made me think about, actually, it's not enough to say there's a task and get on with it. You've got to, you know, understand the motivations and the habits and the kind of personality of the person doing the job. And again, I think that comes back round to the principle, how can you honestly pretend that you know the ins and outs of how somebody's mind is working? You should work hard at it, but actually people are complex, and it's getting under the skin of that I think helps to, you know, drive somebody to perform as well as they possibly can.
Yeah, it's fascinating, Brian. It reminds me of something I read, which was, the book's called Extreme Ownership. It's written by a gentleman called Jocko Willink, who is an ex-Navy SEAL. And the premise of his book is basically what the title would suggest. But he suggested in the book that ultimately, as a leader, you absolutely own and ultimately have accountability for everything that your team does, which is quite interesting if you really start to test in, say, like, whenever anything that my team or organization doesn't go well, then ultimately it comes back to you. And if you try and test that and really answer those questions that you end up posing to yourself, brutally honestly, I actually struggle to disprove his theory, because if you delegate a task and to somebody and it's not done to the standard you want it done, then perhaps, as you said, you delegated to the wrong person. Maybe you didn't understand what else they had on. Maybe you didn't set a realistic timetable. You didn't check in with them. So actually, if you really do want to take ownership of things as a leader, you can trace things back to you. It's that old sort of cliche, isn't it? Every time you point a finger at somebody, there's three fingers pointing back at you, which I'm not sure that quite translates via an audio podcast about seeing a picture of a clenched fist with one finger pointing out. But it's an interesting, really interesting point that you raise.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I haven't read the book, but I mean, in a way, that I'm struck by that example that you give about, that's the difference between accountability and responsibility, isn't it? You can't be responsible for everything that happens. You know, the universe has its own laws, and you know, I'm minded of that lovely scene in the kids' film Kung Fu Panda. It says, no matter how try you hard, that peach tree will always be a peach tree. You might be able to plant it somewhere else, but you can't change that. So you're not responsible for everything, but you are ultimately accountable if you're the leader. And that's why I think that kind of principle of having, a bit like they do in the airline industry, which helped transform the safety record across the world, is that sort of no blame culture. So yes, something will go wrong. And if we're encourage a culture in which people put their hands up and explain why, and we learn from that, we'll continue to be an organization that improves all the time rather than one that goes backwards. So I think it's that it can sometimes be a bit scary thinking, am I responsible for every single thing that happens? Well, you know you can't be, but what you can be is accountable and to drive the kind of that culture of improvement.
Yeah, absolutely. Brian, I'd love to change tack slightly on the questions, if that's okay, and focus in a little bit on your sort of current expertise and the current role in terms of mental health, well-being, and all of that good stuff that is so important right now. I read a study recently that suggested that around about a third of businesses plan on increasing their spending on well-being in the immediate future. And in my work, many of the leaders I speak to say they know that they need to do this, but what they don't know, where they struggle, is understanding what to do or where to put that investment. Like, what would you suggest are some of the most effective things that leaders and organizations can be doing now? Where could they, where should they invest to really focus on sort of looking after the people that they've got the privilege and responsibility to lead?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, the kind of level of awareness or the literacy around mental health is changing in a way that we've probably never seen it before. I mean, I don't think a single event, with the possible exception, and I'm not even sure that matches it, of the Second World War, has shaped our lives as much as this has. I think that research is absolutely correct. Certainly, we are speaking to more people who are saying, well, you know, look, our folks are returning from furlough or working from home, and actually we can now realise that we have to take care and support people with their mental health as well as their physical health, and we're a bit stuck. And the way that I look at it is there's probably three kind of tiers to it. There's the work that you might do, let's call it broadly prevention. How do you create the right kind of culture, the kind of social norms, if you like, around mental health, that people have the confidence to be able to talk about it in the same way that they might talk about their physical health if it's either a problem or something kind of good's happening? You know, what's the mood music that you create in the organization to encourage people to take care of their mental health, and all the kind of hygiene factors like sleep and rest and lunch breaks and all those things that really help? So that's the kind of prevention piece, if you like. And then I think the kind of second entry point is around early intervention. When things might be going wrong with an individual or a team, what skills and knowledge have you given managers to recognize the signs of mental health, mental ill health, and to kind of understand those techniques for helping people, support, you know, give them the techniques for learning and practicing the resilience that might help? And how do you step in well? You know, what's the conversation that you have? How do you do that without stigmatizing somebody? What's your responsibility and what's not? All that sort of stuff, I think, is really important. And then I think the third, Ben, is around that postvention, because, you know, most businesses, because we all have mental health, because one in four people at any one time will have a mental health problem, things will go wrong. You know, no business is capable of getting that all right, as we've talked about a second ago. So if somebody does go off unwell, how do you bring that person back well? And I was struck with a really good example recently of an organization that had somebody who went off unwell with an eating disorder. And what they did was they had a RAP, a wellness return action plan. We helped them with that. And really, that thing where somebody's come back unwell, you want to show that you care, so you ask. But in asking, you force the person to relive it and go through it again, and they don't want to go through it. So just some techniques there about how the person could avoid lunch hour, kind of note to manager and to teams, don't ask me about it, I know you care, so you don't need to show me that you do. So I think if you get those three things right, the kind of the prevention, creating the right culture, the early intervention, stepping in well, and the postvention, helping somebody return to work who might have been unwell, then you're probably really beginning to crack it. And organisations like ourselves, Rethink and Mental Health UK, we can certainly help.
Yeah, brilliant. I've a two-part question, Brian, to immediately follow up on that. On that early intervention piece that you mentioned, what are some of the warning signs or things to look out for that would indicate that somebody might be struggling with their mental health, or indeed maybe signs to look out for in ourselves that kind of we're perhaps not in the best shape and need to pay more attention to looking after ourselves, seek support or make some changes? What should we be looking out for?
Well, you know, if I'm speaking in jargon, signs of stress tend to show themselves in physical, cognitive, emotional and behavioural ways. But I suppose it really kind of comes down to a lot of common sense, doesn't it? If you know your staff and you know how somebody is, so let's say, for example, somebody who's normally fairly quiet and withdrawn, then being quiet and withdrawn is not a sign necessarily that they're struggling. But equally, if you've got somebody who's a much more kind of extrovert and you're kind of really struggling to connect with them, that might be a sign. I think where it begins to be difficult for people as managers and others think, well, what's the right way to step in? And that's why, in a sense, I think doing that prevention piece, to kind of creating the culture where people know that it's okay to acknowledge if they're having a difficulty, as that kind of case, if you like, has been established first. So I think it's just about having a basic knowledge of the common mental health conditions that people face, getting to know your team and trying to make that first kind of conversation the right kind of conversation, so that, you know, if it can be resolved in terms of, I don't know, more flexible hours or taking some leave or maybe some temporary adjustment to work duties, then well and good. But actually somebody might need to be referred on to EAP or indeed encouraged, perhaps if you've got that relationship, to seek help from the GP. But I think it's getting all of that together, really, Ben, that guarantees the best chance of success.
Yeah, that's great, Brian. I think personally, from my experience, I think back to being a young leader in the army, one of the things that was drummed into us again and again was really get to know your soldiers, which is partly because if we were going to ask soldiers to put their lives on the line, they wouldn't actually do that because of military discipline and military law. They'd only really do that because they knew we as their leader knew them as an individual, as a human, and cared about them. So that kind of knowing your people and spending time on the relationships was so important. But I think if we start to apply some psychological research or concepts on top of that, what I think really getting to know people does is it builds and creates psychological safety, right? And creates, as you talked about, that environment where people feel okay to sort of open up and talk about things and fears, worries, concerns without having any fear themselves that they're going to be judged because of that.
Yeah, I think that's spot on. I mean, that notion of psychological safety, I mean, it sounds quite frightening. It sounds like a lot to take on for a business, but really what you're talking about is a parallel to having a physically safe environment. You know, you look at the health and safety record of most companies in the UK and Europe and beyond. Most companies have realised that actually putting your employees at risk of serious injury or even death is something to, you know, it's both a moral imperative as well as a business imperative. And I was struck recently, I went a couple of years ago, in fact, down to the Farringdon section of the Crossrail project, and it's a huge project and a very diverse workforce, mostly certainly in terms of the kind of structural stuff, heavily dominated by men. But of course, it's a very, you know, complex business doing Crossrail, so a really, really kind of broad range of people. And they showed me their accident book for a particular week that I'd visited. And I think my recollection is one person had sprained one finger. And, you know, you think about a project as huge as that, that has come about because of years and years of progress and knowledge and creating a culture where, you know, that is kind of critical to success. And psychological safety is simply the, as if you like, the mental health component of that is creating a culture where people are not going off ill because they're frightened to raise the subject with a manager, or, you know, coming to work but not performing because they feel awful. So I think it's a principle that, you know, we do well to educate ourselves on and apply in any business, regardless of what industry you're actually in.
Yeah, and talking of education, Brian, if leaders are looking to improve maybe their own knowledge and awareness and maybe skills around that early intervention, or if they're looking to do the same for their team members, where can they start with that? Where can they go? What are good sources of, where are the good sources of information, advice, training?
Yeah, well, I mean, I would, you know, there are lots of great charities there. I mean, you'll forgive me. I'll start with our own. So
please do.
Certainly, mentalhealthuk.org is a great place to go. We work with a lot of businesses across the country. We've been working with Lloyds Banking Group for 4 to 5 years now, and that's been an incredible project. So certainly we can support businesses with that. If people just want to educate themselves in the kind of common conditions ourselves, or Rethink Mental Illness, as I say, is a really good charity. Lots of depth there, particularly for people who are experiencing a more severe mental health problem. But there's lots of charities out there, who can help, and lots of other sources of support, including NHS, if people want to educate themselves. And I think a basic level education is pretty good for any manager, because, as you were saying earlier, I think, you know, if you're going to ask a lot from people, you've got to try to get under people's skin a little bit, and being able to have a basic level of knowledge about something that we all live with seems, it doesn't strike me as that too big an ask for any manager.
And Brian, the next question is quite a practical, granular one, but it's based on a conversation that I had with a senior leader and a member of their team a few weeks ago. So just love to sort of get your take on perhaps how you would deal with this situation. So the question really is around what can leaders be doing right now to support their teams and individuals who may be struggling. And to give you the practical example, say I was talking to this senior leader recently, and they know that there's a particular member of their team who has really been struggling with working from home. They was on furlough and then sort of on flexi furlough, struggled a little bit with the isolation, kind of not being in an office with their colleagues. I mean, and as a result, they were starting to become perhaps more and more distant and detached from the rest of the team. And the conversation I had with the leader was that short of adding in another virtual check-in, which they were reluctant to do because a lot of people are tired of those, like they weren't really sure what else to do to help. They really wanted to, and there was lots of empathy and compassion there, but they just didn't know what the best thing to do was. Like, what would your advice be in that very specific example?
Well, I think in any really difficult challenge, and that's a really powerful example of it. I mean, my first counsel to that person would be, look, you know, don't be too hard on yourself. There are certain things that it becomes almost impossible to resolve, and we are living in an unprecedentedly difficult time. I mean, I think there's a few things, not necessarily in order, but sometimes breaking the chain of command helps a little bit, I think. So, you know, is there a buddy that person can be connected with? Is the team kind of working informally? Are there other kind of changes that people could make in terms of their working day? I mean, so one of the things that I've personally emphasized, I mean, I'm not really guilty by and large of telling my team to do something, but I more or less kind of got to that point in January when I said, look, I kind of really insist, folks, that you try to make sure you have a lunch hour, that you get outside. If you're having meetings, you know, don't do them on Zoom or whatever, because it can become exhausting. So there's definitely something about also modeling that behavior yourself. I mean, I don't know whether or not that person has an employment assistance program that they can pass people on to. I know that can be quite a difficult thing, but again, if that norm has been created, then it won't feel like a punishment exercise that you're doing something wrong, but actually the desire to support people. And I suppose the only other thing that really strikes me as you've kind of asked the question, Ben, is that I had an incident where one of my team, somebody who's a kind of few levels down, so I don't tend to come into a huge amount of contact with, it was a good 4 or 5 months before I realized that she was balancing her laptop on an ironing board. A young person, you know, living in a London flat with a shared flat. And it did kind of make me think, well, you know, why is it taking so long for me to find that out? Because, you know, we've kind of said to people, we'll give you some budget to get a kind of proper seat and a proper desk. So I think some of those basic hygiene factors that may not be noticeable even to the person themselves can be one of the factors in driving that real sense of isolation and loneliness. So I think as long as you've created the culture where you're really encouraging people to support one another, to acknowledge their difficulties, there comes a point when there probably isn't a great deal more that you could do.
It's interesting. I've seen a lot of pictures of people who've created a workstation at home out of ironing boards and upturned laundry baskets. I think I even heard one story about somebody who had broken a toe because they'd done that, and then the laptop had fallen off of its precariously balanced perch and landed on their toe, which actually clearly we shouldn't laugh at, right? Because it's the reality of lots of people. And it reminds me of an analogy I'm sure I've shared it on a previous episode of this podcast.
Or perhaps a previous conversation with me.
Yeah, perhaps. But one of the analogies I heard and then I worked really hard at making sure I wasn't repeating it early on in the COVID pandemic was this, but we're all in the same boat, aren't we? And then this wasn't my saying, so, and I don't know who first coined the phrase, but credit to whoever it was. They said, actually, no, we're not all in the same boat at all. What we are all in the same is it's the same storm, but we're all in entirely different boats based on our sort of family, our circumstances, where we live, so many factors. And if you carry on the analogy, sort of some people have been quite comfortable in a super yacht where they're not really noticing too much of an impact of the storm. And there's others who are in a small rowing boat, and others perhaps who feel like they're clinging to a piece of driftwood in the stormy seas, right? So it's really important, I think, as leaders, especially when we're thinking about people's mental health and mental well-being, to realize that we're not in the same boat, right?
I think that's an absolutely brilliant analogy. And you know, one of the interesting things about that is, of course, it applies in the pandemic, because we all know we're in a storm. But you know, for a lot of people, life is a storm. You know, most people have complexities in their life. I don't know if you know anybody whose life is completely perfect and trouble-free. I don't.
No.
And, you know, yes, we have to, you know, we're all professionals. We try to bring the best version of ourselves. But I think it circles right back to that point at the start, doesn't it, about getting to really know your workforce. Not to the point where you're prying into people's lives. I think what really helps break some of the difficulties that then end up appearing, because sometimes people are, you know, as you say, just hanging on to a bit of flotsam and jetsam in their life. And yet you're expecting miracles from them as if they're in that super yacht, and it's not realistic. And I suppose the other thing that occurs to me, and the way it goes back to the previous question, is really important to remember that there's an incredibly strong connection with people's physical health and their mental health. The vast majority of people who have experienced a long-term physical health condition have an accompanying mental health condition. And why? Because it's really tough living with a long health, physical health problem. But, you know, the same thing goes. If you're an active person and you've been at home and the iron has landed on your foot and you can't go out running, that will soon have an impact on your physical health. So I suppose going back to your previous question, just making sure that that person is really well set up, that they're getting access to exercise, that they're, you know, all those other hygiene factors that really help us perform well in our work because they have a direct effect on our mental health.
Brian, I want to be very respectful of your time, especially seeing as this is the second chunk of your time you've kindly given up. I just want to give you the opportunity, if I can. Can you tell us a little bit about Click, please?
Yeah, so Mental Health UK is a partnership of four charities in England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. And our Welsh charity, Hafal, had been running Click for some time. And when the pandemic came, we had the chance really to scale that up. And essentially what it is, it's maybe it goes back to some of our previous conversation, because it's intended really as a space for people to go to talk about their mental health challenges with other people who've been through the same experience. So it's a peer support, online peer support service. It's you know, it's kind of available free to anyone. It's just a very simple register. And it's moderated 24/7. So if you have a particular mental health challenge and you want some advice and support from somebody who might have been through the same thing, it's a great place to go. And of course, we encourage people to post on people to it, because if it may be that they're kind of getting stuck themselves on a particular issue. And we can also work with employers to create a version of that for them and their workforce. So it's a really great thing that we've been able to do, generously funded, I have to say, by the government, to scale that up really quickly. And it's, as I say, it's there currently for anyone who wants to use it.
Brilliant. We'll make sure we put links to Click in the show notes for anybody that wants to check it out. Other than that, Brian, where can people get in touch with you or find out more about the organisations that you lead?
Well, I mean, you'd easily find me on LinkedIn or Instagram or Twitter. I'm Brian C. Dow, and the two organisations. So it's mentalhealthuk.org and rethink.org.uk. Oh, no, it's rethink.org. I should know that, really, shouldn't I, Ben? I've only been working there for 7 years. I think I'd know that. Anyway, you'll find us on the website, and I'm usually easy to track. You'll know me by my huge hairstyle that I've got. No, hold on. No, that you won't recognise me by my huge hairstyle. But fortunately for your listeners, this is just a podcast. And we're not getting
I'm laughing because the technically failed attempt last week included video as well. So, exactly what you look like.
Yes, exactly. That's why I was hesitating, because I suppose you can see what I look like, but of course you can't, because we didn't quite work out for us the first time. But you'll find me on Twitter.
Yeah, there you go, folks. We're keeping the conversation very, very real. Brian, one final question that I think I asked you last week. As we start to emerge from a national lockdown here in the UK, at least, and as things go back to, in inverted air commas, normal, what are one of the things that you are personally most looking forward to for the coming months?
Well, I just want to hug my friends. I mean, I probably wouldn't put myself down as the world's most tactile person, but we're not supposed to live without human touch. You know, I think that's why some people have found the pandemic so hard, actually. Just the notion of seeing some of my friends who I'm really missing, and family who haven't seen for a long time, and giving people a big hug. I mean, I'll ask people's permission first, obviously. I'll just go randomly hugging people in the street, you know. But yeah, I'm really looking, and I've to be honest, if immediately followed that hug, I can be sitting down with a pint in a beer garden, then that will be heaven.
Sounds idyllic. So very much to look forward to. Brian, thank you so much for coming on the show. Again, really appreciate your time. Fantastic conversation. And I know everybody listening is going to get so much value from it. So thank you very much indeed.
It's been my pleasure, Ben. Again.
I hope you found that conversation valuable, folks, but more importantly, I hope that you're able to make some small positive changes as a result. for yourselves, for those around you, or for those that you lead. If you did get value from the episode, then please do rate, review, and subscribe via iTunes, as it really does enable us to keep bringing you more and more episodes of the podcast. Do also visit ben-morton.com, where you can connect with me, find out more about my leadership mentoring and team development work, along with details of all of my online programs via the tools and resources page. That's it for this episode. See you again soon, folks, and lead on.